Hi, I'm Trevor, and welcome to Catching Up on Cinema. If you aren't familiar with the program, Catching Up on Cinema is a film analysis podcast wherein we introduce each other to films, expand our cinematic horizons, and, in essence, catch up on our cinema. So, it is the month of August, 2023, and shocker, we actually may have a theme for this month. Not something we've done in at least a whole calendar month. So, to dispel the mystery, a couple years ago, in 2021, we did a little thing that we called Action April. And in Action April, Kyle and I, as well as, I believe, my brother and at least one other guest, I believe Kyle's brother, Nick, he guested on, I think, the Commando episode. We devoted an entire month to talking about action cinema. Like, more specifically, like the specific theme of Action April was to cover some big hits from some of the Mount Rushmore, I guess, of traditional action hero cinema. So that would be Sylvester Stallone, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Jean-Claude Van Damme, and just for shits and giggles, Steven Seagal. So I believe, if memory serves, we did Rambo First Blood Part 2, Commando, Hard Target, as I like to call it, and On Deadly Ground. Because if you're going to talk about a Steven Seagal movie, it may as well be, you know, the one he directed that is fun for all the wrong reasons. Anyway, that was Action April. It is obviously not April. This particular episode is dropping in August, so I guess we're doing Action August. And the theme I have in mind for this month is kind of hard to sum up, so I'll try my best to talk my way through this. That is bullshit my way through it. So what I have in mind is there was a phenomenon that occurred in the 90s, very specifically. There was a major phenomenon, but then there were a lot of tangential ones, like spin-offs from it. And that was, of course, natural disaster films. In the 70s, I believe, be it Earthquake or The Towering Inferno, there were a lot of disaster films, natural or otherwise. Disaster films were kind of a thing. The airport films from which the airplane films were inspired. Airplane films are hilarious. They're comedies. They're parodies. And in the 90s, we kind of saw a revival of that, kind of similar to how we saw a lot of 60s television series adapted to film. It's just one of those nostalgia wave things, I guess. I guess Hollywood got nostalgic for disaster cinema, potentially because of breakthroughs in special effects technology. Because remember, 1993 was when we got Jurassic Park, and CGI characters became very much a possibility, and CGI was one of those things that was very intriguing to a lot of studios. I mean, for fuck's sake, Brad and I, on the most recent Tales from the Shelf, we were talking about the 90s career of Jan de Bont, and aside from the Speed films, plural, he also had Twister and The Haunting under his belt, both of which were films that largely existed, at least as far as I understand, as exhibitions for CGI technology in cinema. So anyway, we had disaster cinema being very much a thing. We had Deep Impact and Armageddon. We had Volcano and Dante's Peak. To a lesser extent, I guess, Independence Day. It's kind of in the same vein as a disaster film, albeit with, you know, space aliens and whatnot. We are inundated with this stuff in terms of blockbuster cinema in the 90s. But in addition to that, we also had high concept action thrillers, wherein a lot of times, and I want to say that this was probably built off of the fallout of the success of Die Hard. The structure of Die Hard is it's an isolated action thriller, wherein you do get drama both inside the location, the Nakatomi building, as well as outside, but for the most part, the action takes place in a confined space, and it has a kind of a cat and mouse rhythm to it. It's very much a specific subgenre or subcategory of action film. So I want to say that the high concept action thriller was kind of residual from that, like born from the same DNA as the success of Die Hard. So while what I'm referring to doesn't necessarily have to take place in a confined space, it's just an action film with a gimmick, essentially. Like I said, this is a very, very grossly long-winded explanation for what I'm trying to get at, and I apologize for that. But more specifically, what I'm wanting to talk about, and I hope this doesn't piss off Kyle, because this is definitely going to pigeonhole us into a really dumb concept, an oddly specific one. What I would like to talk about this month is 90s action thrillers that the gimmick comes in the form of the environment in some fashion, because without even doing any research, I can think of at least a half dozen films wherein this is a factor. In fact, it's not of the era, but I do remember citing that fact in my talk with Brad from the Cinema Speak podcast when we reviewed The Hurricane Heist, because I was telling him, like, wow, this makes me nostalgic for action movies that were coming out when I was a kid, because essentially it's exactly as the title suggests. It's a heist film, kind of Die Hard-esque in some ways, where there's a lot of subterfuge and deception going on with, you know, the motivations of the villains and whatnot, in the midst of a natural disaster in the form of a hurricane. So in a lot of cases, the environment ends up posing more danger to the cast than the, quote, villains in the film. You know, that film does actually have villains, but for example of what I'm talking about, some movies that we won't be talking about this month, largely because I don't know how much availability I'm going to have, and by extension also Kyle, who I'm hoping to get back on the show very shortly here. I have a very busy August ahead of me, so I don't have time to do research and like really commit or even really make a schedule for myself when it comes to recording episodes this month. I'm just kind of haphazardly fitting these in when I have time. So I apologize if anybody out there wants to be in on some of these conversations, but my schedule's super fucked this month, August that is. Anyway, some movies that come to mind that we won't be talking about, they're actually much better films probably and much better candidates for this theme that I'm kind of loosely constructing here this month. Firestorm, for one, not a good film, but it's you know, Howie Long as a smoke jumper who gets caught up in it's like a prison break, I believe, in the midst of a natural disaster in the form of a forest fire. Cliffhanger, the film which inspired so many of the films that we will be talking about this month. It's Sylvester Stallone versus John Lithgow. Michael Rooker's in there as well as a lot of really familiar faces. It's a heist film that takes place in the mountain range, and involves literal cliffhanging. Movies of this nature, where it's like we're having an action thriller, but a big part of the gimmick is where we're setting the action. And a lot of times the characterizations, a lot of the types of characters we're dealing with, in particular the heroes, are people that are out of their depth in kind of a John McClane sort of way, where it's like they stumble ass backwards into an evil scheme of some sort, and then they kind of have to just figure it out using their wits. Because a lot of this was the era of the non-action hero. Again, we're talking about Fallout from trends earlier in the era of action cinema, because remember, we'd been exposed to a huge number of Arnold Schwarzenegger films wherein he's always presented as a larger-than-life figure. He's Arnold. It's kind of impossible, at least, you know, during his peak years, to cast him in a film and not treat him as a larger-than-life, almost comical kind of figure in how big and imposing and over-the-top his characterization is. The 90s was kind of the era of the lithe and witty and clever hero, where if not especially physically imposing, but scrappy and quick-witted, quick on their feet, kind of like in terms of improvisation and whatnot. More of like an Indiana Jones than, say, a John Matrix, I guess, was more common in the 90s. And that's certainly what we're going to be talking about here today. We're going to be talking about all month long movie action thrillers that involve some sort of environmental hazard gimmick, along with the thrills and spills. So the first movie I'm going to be talking about this month, and in case you couldn't tell by my insane ramblings, this is just going to be a solo affair. It's probably going to be a very brief episode on top of that, because I don't have a whole lot to say, nor have I had any time to do any research on this. But the first film I'm going to be talking about here in Action August is Darren Sarafian's Terminal Velocity from 1994. Just for shits and giggles, I selected all the films this month preemptively, and also I'm attacking them in order of release. So that's what lands me here on Terminal Velocity, is it came out in September 23rd, 1994. Funny enough, it was not the only film of its nature to drop in that calendar year. So if you're not aware, the gimmick, the action thriller, the environmental thrill gimmick associated with this film is it involves skydiving. There are quite a lot of aerial action scenes in this film. Well, a handful. Quite a lot of the action actually occurs with all the characters' feet on the ground. But if you look at the poster and you read the title, you can tell what they're trying to sell you on in terms of the thrills, I guess, in the film. So plot summary is, the tagline. A maverick skydiver and a former KGB agent, wow, spoilers, team up to stop the Russian mafia from stealing gold. And as I said, this was directed by Darren Sarafian. He's an Armenian-American director, apparently part of a very large family of Armenian-American film professionals. His father was also a director, as far as I understand. In glancing at his filmography, just to point it out, he does have a Van Damme film on his resume. That would come in the form of Death Warrant, which is not terrible. It was written by David S. Goyer, which is always a fun trivia factoid in his Dark Knight years. He's still a working writer, I believe. Big name one, too. But yeah, Mr. Sarafian also has, I think, a couple of Christopher Lambert films under his belt. The Gunman is one that I've seen talked about in action community circles and whatnot. I don't know its reputation, but it is a poster and a title that I see dropped quite often. And aside from that, the vast majority of his credits, his directing credits, are television. And they're vast. He has worked on a lot of shows and a lot of super high profile ones. I don't know how many episodes of these shows he's done, but just to throw some names out there, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Lost, House, Fringe, the revival of Nikita, not La Femme Nikita, but just Nikita from 2012, Hemlock Grove, which I know a good friend of mine watched ironically and had quite a lot of fun laughing at it. The Strain, the Guillermo del Toro project. He's done quite a lot of television work, but in terms of his film credits, he's done some action cinema, just say that much. In terms of cast, we have Carlos Estevez, Charlie Sheen, as Richard Ditch Brody. That's an action hero name if I've ever heard one. Ditch Brody, as kind of a hotshot skydiver type character. Kind of gives off a little bit of a Bruce Campbell vibe in this film, which I very much welcomed. I can't speak for Charlie Sheen's character as a person, but as a screen presence, I do generally find him affable. I feel that he's a pretty capable actor, but in particular, he does, and again, this is all just opinion, and I do know that his personal life is very different from his professional life, but he does have comedic chops. I've always felt that, and that again, that's a personal thing. I do think he can be very, very funny. At this point in his career in 1994, I would like to point out that this was a big year for him. The original Major League, came out in 1989, where he played Ricky Vaughn, a Wild Thing, the pitcher with the glasses and the goofy haircut. I believe he actually had a background in baseball, probably at like a collegiate level or AAA level or something. But 1994 was a very big year for Charlie Sheen. He had this film to kick things off, but he also had The Chase and Major League 2, both of which I believe were pretty well received. Both of them, I don't know how much money they made in theaters, but they certainly made the rounds on cable. This film included, actually. And I'll get to that in a minute here, but I am a huge fan of the Hot Shots films. Hot Shots Part Deux came out in 1993, as did a favorite of my regular co-host Kyle, The Three Musketeers. He has roles in both of those films. He's a starring role in the Hot Shots films. I love Hot Shots Part Deux. In fact, that was one of the earlier movies that I had the girlfriend watch. But I will point out that Mr. Sheen's filmography does seem to take a dip post-1994. Like, The Arrival came out in 1996, and I know that got a decent amount of hype, but I seriously doubt it did especially well in the theaters, and upon closer inspection, it appears Terminal Velocity did not make its money back. So I haven't looked into The Chase or Major League 2, but maybe 1994 was like critically an okay year, but maybe not financially. I don't know. But yeah, it does appear that his theatrical offerings, the quality of them kind of thinned out post-1994. But it worked out, man. I mean, he found his way to Spin City in, I believe, the late 90s or early 2000s. And I thought he was just fine filling in for Michael J. Fox. I thought he handled that pretty well. And then, of course, Two and a Half Men came about, and the rest is history, Tiger Blood and whatnot. And in addition to Charlie Sheen, we also have Natasha Kinski, who was born in West Germany, actress. Not somebody I'm super familiar with, but I do know that she has a very good reputation. She's worked with a lot of very high-profile directors, including, again, a person whose life outside of the film industry can't speak for, Roman Polanski. She worked with him on the film Tess. She also worked with Wim Wenders on Paris, Texas in 1984. Very accomplished actress, as far as I understand. But again, not one that I'm super familiar with. But she does kind of take center stage when it comes to quite a lot of the action stuff in this film. And I thought she acquitted herself quite well. She and Charlie Sheen have a decent rapport in this film. It's a complicated rapport, but it sells pretty well on film. In addition to them, we also have Melvin Van Peebles in a very small role, but he stands out. He makes an impression as a pilot. But more importantly, we have James Gandolfini as essentially the chief antagonist of the film. This was very early in his film career. I believe he had been a stage actor for quite a while up to this point, probably at least 10 years. But in looking at his filmography, this was very, very early. He has a uncredited role in The Last Boy Scout in 1991, A Stranger Among Us in 1992, and then 1993 is when he started getting a lot of work in the form of Money for Nothing, a big one, but a small role as far as I know, True Romance, Mr. Wonderful in 1993, and then 1994, Terminal Velocity. 1995, he would get Crimson Tide, which I thought he was terrific in, and I really love that movie. James Gandolfini was a national treasure in a lot of ways. He is sorely missed. He's been dead a very long time, I believe 10 years at this point, which is really, really sad, because his contribution to the film and television world was incredible. He was a really amazing actor with a lot of range. He could embody a shockingly wide array of characters. A very big, imposing man that could be very, very sensitive or terrifying, depending on what the role demanded. And in fact, like, while this is early in his career, and the movie didn't exactly make money or anything, the character that he's asked to play does actually afford him the opportunity to strut his stuff as an actor just a little bit. I really did like his portrayal as the Ben Pinkwater character. He pulls a Hans Gruber in this film. In fact, there's a lot of diehardisms in this film. including the swerve as to what the intentions of the villains are. At one point, Charlie Sheen's character thinks that it involves a nuclear threat of some sort or nuclear material being transported across state lines or something. It ends up being a gold heist instead. And when I say he pulls a Hans Gruber, James Gandolfini's character, that is, what I'm referring to is, of course, the sequence in the original Die Hard wherein Alan Rickman tricks or attempts to trick Bruce Willis's John McClane by masking his German accent, because up to that point, the two characters had never met face to face. So he basically tries to conceal his identity because he's aware that, oh, this guy doesn't know what I look like. I could be anybody, even though I sound like fucking Alan Rickman. And it's a very, very distinct voice, even when I try to very shittily cover my accent. Good plan, Hans. It didn't work out, in case you aren't aware. Of course you're aware. You're listening to an episode from a podcast theme, Action August. Of course you've seen Die Hard 50 million times, just like most Americans. Maybe you're not American. I don't know that. Anyway, yeah, James Gandolfini pulls a Gruber in this, where his introduction, his early scenes in the film, he's playing kind of a weaselly, kind of meek character with thick glasses and a sensitivity to dust. And he sells it really well, where he like hunches over to make himself look smaller. He changes his speech affect just a little bit to sound less threatening. And it works. It's really neat seeing him put eye drops in his eyes and like blow his nose and look weaselly and out of place everywhere he is. A lot of this film takes place in the desert, and he's largely dressed in like business casual attire throughout the whole film. But then there's a big reveal where it's like, oh no, he's a fucking KGB agent that speaks Russian and stabs people. And because it's James Gandolfini, the turn is very natural and believable. Really miss the guy. But in addition to that, like probably the chief heavy in this film was a real shocker to me. He has bleach blonde hair in this film, such that, and he's wearing a leather jacket, such that he kind of makes me think of Everett McGill from the Steven Seagal film Under Siege 2. He gives off a little bit of that vibe, at least in terms of aesthetics, not in terms of performance. But Christopher McDonald is the chief heavy in this film, and he is permanently cranked up to 11 in all of his scenes. I don't think he speaks much of his dialogue. Almost all of it is screamed, and he's just perpetually sweaty and frustrated. And it's so bizarre seeing him in this role, because kind of similar to Charlie Sheen, when I think of him, I think funny. I think effortlessly funny. Christopher McDonald is hilarious. Shooter McGavin. I mean, he wouldn't be Shooter McGavin for, holy shit, 2 years. I'm actually kind of amazed that Happy Gilmore didn't come out until 1996. I thought it was earlier. But in addition to that, Christopher McDonald, like, I like him in almost everything I've ever seen him in. He was great in SLC Punk. He has a couple of throwaway lines in there that are just absolutely hilarious. I think a fuck you, dear, is in there when he's in counseling with his wife or something. even Leave It to Beaver. I actually saw that when I was young. He fits the role. He plays it very well. He plays suit dad really well. But he is also just effortlessly funny. And it was so weird seeing him in this kind of role where he is almost exclusively like supposed to be a cartoon character, like bad guy tough. Like he's a goon in this, and not even a verbose one. He does have at least like one chuckle-worthy line that has to do with him having a Cadillac, a Cadillac Alante, that he's very attached to. He has a line, like a lengthy, like a very wordy line of dialogue where he talks at length, unprompted basically, about why he loves this car and why he insists on loading it onto a plane. And I love James Gandolfini's reaction to it, just being like, yeah, that's great. Now shut up and leave me alone. I think he actually says, like, now leave me alone. Like, that's great, buddy. Fuck off. You can tell that, like, they are working together, but they don't actually like each other. And that's kind of an interesting dynamic to have between what is essentially the two chief antagonists of the film. But yeah, Christopher McDonald plays the bat, like a just a goon, like a borderline anonymous goon in this. Big surprise. But anyway, like I said, I'm going to keep this pretty short. But skydiving is very much the action thriller gimmick, the environmental concern that is incorporated into a handful of scenes in the movie. There's at least three, maybe four jump sequences in the film. It actually opens in a fashion, or at least Charlie Sheen's introduction to the film very much feels like one of the early sequences in the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers movie. Basically, there's also a skydiving sequence in that film, if you're not aware. Basically, he like is in Arizona skydiving, and it's this gag where he's doing this daredevil stunt in the middle of the city, and it involves him doing like essentially like a male stripper routine upon landing. But he misses the drop zone, and he ends up landing at a child's birthday party instead of the bachelorette party, which was very cute. But yeah, him having to like hit the targeted landing zone again in the early stages of the movie kind of made me think of Power Rangers, which would not come out for at least another year or two after this. In addition to that, we also get an opening kind of similar to like a Lethal Weapon, where there's like a young woman in peril, and we're lacking for information. Like, we're not entirely sure exactly what's going on during the opening sequence. But then like a woman gets killed, not thrown off a building or anything, or jumps off a building or anything like that, but kind of had that kind of vibe to it. And yeah, we do get a harrowing jump sequence that kind of serves as the catalyst for the plot, wherein the Natasha Kinski character, she basically convinces Charlie Sheen to take her out on a skydiving, like her first skydiving jump, which, as far as I understand, at least current regulations, I think you're required to do a tandem jump as your first jump, like legally speaking. They do pay lip service to that in this film, but she convinces him to let her jump on her own. And then there's some shenanigans where she essentially fakes her own death and in a very convincing fashion. And remember, this is 1994, so all the jump footage is either done for real or using trick photography and or blue screen. So it has a particular thrill to it that it feels very old school, in the same way that you like watching those skydiving stunts and parachute stunts in like James Bond movies feels. Very cozy for somewhat of my relative age range. I'm in my mid-30s, in case you're wondering. But that sequence where she fakes her death, spoiler alert, was pretty well executed. It's also kind of around the time that we start to see the interplay between these two characters, that we start to see that Charlie Sheen has a good handle on the material and this character. This movie didn't review well, nor did it make a whole lot of money or anything. But I'm telling you, I found Charlie Sheen's performance to be very affable. He has a lot of very effortless comedy in this film. A lot of it has to do with him being capable of laughing at himself, and also not pulling a Steven Seagal and trying to be the superior man in everything that he does. Charlie Sheen's character in this is very fallible. And has just enough backstory. I did like the fact that he had like a bright athletic future earlier in his life that is mentioned a couple of times in the film. He was supposed to compete in the 1980 Olympic Games as a gymnast, which just so happens to be the year that the United States did not participate due to boycott, because it was being hosted by the Soviet Union at the time. So it is interesting that you get that kind of vibe from the character in subtle ways, where it's like, this is a person who was prepped for greatness, who just kind of like became not a shiftless layabout or a fuck up or anything, but he just became disillusioned and maybe didn't live up to his potential the way he had planned. And I feel like he incorporates a lot of subtle quirks into his characterization that really made it work for me. Like small things like him, being handed a pistol at one point. I think he's given a revolver, and immediately he pulls the trigger and it it clicks because the safety's still on. And I love the 80-yard line of dialogue of him saying, it's broken! Like, I forget exactly what he says, but something along the lines of, it's broken or it doesn't work. And then Natasha Kinski's just like, it's because you have the safety on, you dumb fuck. But I just love that you hear just like the one click, and then he's like, it's broken! It actually kind of reminded me, weird reference, but it kind of reminded me of a barf of... Of vomit. No, barf. John Candy's character from Spaceballs. There's that bit when they're in like a laser gun fight. And I think he shoots like one shot and then immediately throws his gun on the ground. And it's this offhand line of dialogue that you either hear it or you don't. But he's just like, oh, out of ammo. It almost felt like a supporting cast member like bias or something, where it's like, you're not one of the main heroes, so like your gun doesn't work as well as the princess or Lone Star, sorry barf. But yeah, I love that he is not adept with a gun. I don't think he actually kills anyone directly in the film, with the exception of he causes the death of at least two people. Both Christopher McDonald and James Gandolfini. Again, spoiler alert. But I don't think they actually have him like ever defeat anyone in a physical contest. He does get into a couple of dust-ups, like a couple of scraps, but he only runs away or puts up a fight. He never actually wins. Again, stuff that Steven Seagal would not allow himself to be seen doing on film. And yeah, he's not adept at a lot of the things he's being asked to do. He is a fish out of water. And it kind of works that way, because the Natasha Kinski character in the film is the spy. She's the one that is proficient in all the things that they're doing throughout the film. And he's just kind of the tag-along character that tries his best to keep up. And he's bitter and resentful the whole time. He's constantly complaining. But I never found it annoying. And like other subtle touches, like the standout, like the showy instance of it is he's not so subtly flirting with her, and we do have like a gross moment of misogyny where he's talking with his coworker about like really wanting to bang Natasha Kinski as he's like gearing up to go up in the plane with her for their jump before she's faked her death and stuff. This is early in the movie. And they're in the plane together, he and Natasha Kinski, and she basically tells him to his face that I'm on to you. I know that you really want to bang me, and that you're talking shit with your coworkers behind my back. Like you're not as professional and kind as you're making yourself out to be. Because this is him like trying to, like, she's pretending to be nervous and he's like offering to like calm her down. He's like, you should sit in my lap. It's like, yeah, that's subtle, buddy. She calls him a walking penis. She's like, I'm not dumb enough to trust my life to a walking penis. And his retort is something along the lines of like, well, just for the record, I'm not just a walking penis. I'm a flying penis. It's like, you know, it's stupid, but it kind of worked. And there's a bit where he's being forced to like raid a corporate office on her behalf. Of course, they have to skydive their way into the facility, because that's the skill set of the stunt team that we have on board for this production. We may as well use them for everything they're worth. Also, the film's called Terminal Velocity, which is said in the film. They actually title drop. I love it when they do that. That should be required for every movie ever made. You need to say the name of your movie at least once in the film. The Living Daylights. He is being tasked with raiding a corporate office. They shut down the power, or she does, and then she's like, you gotta go up in the office because like security cameras and like security personnel, they'll know who I am, but you're just some guy. You're Topper Harley. Nobody's gonna recognize you. You're Wild Thing. Nobody's gonna recognize you. And she sends him into like a back office, and she's like, okay, now you see there's a clothesline, right? I need you to take all the clothes off the rack, off the line. And then he cuts her off and he thinks he's being all clever, and he's like, oh yeah, I already know what you're getting at. There's a safe. I'm gonna go straight to the safe on the floor, right? And then she cuts him off and she's like, no, the safe on the floor is just a distraction for dummy, for like idiots. And he's like, did you just call me an idiot? Like, he doesn't say that though. And there's other instances of that as well in the film where it could be more verbose. Like, it could be, the movie could be louder and more fucking annoying. I can't stand that with certain films when characters just will not shut the fuck up. It's like, not every frame of your movie needs to be packed with noise. Michael Bay, I'm looking at you. Not every frame needs to be jam-packed with noise, either audio or visually. Not saying Michael Bay is a bad director. I'm just saying that his use of Shia LaBeouf, I don't know if it was like him, like if he had something out for that young man or something, but just having him and all the other young male characters in those Transformers movies just constantly go, 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 just constantly screaming just drives me nuts. Anyway, there's a bit in the movie that shows quite a lot of restraint where Charlie Sheen is thinking that he may have inadvertently caused the death of the Natasha Kinski character when she faked her death, because we do see a body hit the ground and it bounces. It's nasty. It achieves terminal velocity. And in the aftermath of that, when he's considering, somebody died. I don't understand how, because I did everything right and I tried my best to save her, but somebody's dead and I was involved. His buddy, his coworker that he was talking about, getting in her pants with, he actually approaches Charlie Sheen. He's like, wow, we joked about something like this happening? I don't think we're going to be doing that anymore. And Charlie Sheen doesn't say anything. The director, I assume, made a good call there and just had him, framed him correctly, blocked out the scene correctly, and just made effective use of close-ups and just facial expressions to convey, this is a man who is very much up in his own head at the moment, and he doesn't have words for that particular topic at the moment. Maybe later, and he does, but that scene is just a person talking at him, and that worked really, really well for me. It showed some restraint. I appreciate that. But anyway, calling back to the vault in the closet sequence, because it's just a small thing that I appreciated, was she calls him an idiot by virtue of him falling for the bait of the lock in the floor. But then she tells him, okay, so I need you to take all the clothes off, like I told you to, off the pole, and then I need you to take the pole and unscrew it, because there's a gadget, a cylinder hidden within it. And it's just a subtle thing, but when he takes the pole off and he looks in it, the cylinder slides out and it bops him in the face. It's not smooth. Like he looks amateurish, he looks klutzy. And I was like, oh, that's that's cute, because they could have done another take, but it slides out and it bops him on the nose, and he's just like, well, okay, I guess I got it. And then, of course, it erupts into a very brief chase sequence where, again, because we have the stunt crew that we have and the gimmick of the film is aerial stuff, he has to escape via parachute. And Chris McDonald, shoots at him a whole bunch, and it's kind of a non-action scene. It's more just a brief escape, but it's something. And that's kind of the movie, honestly, is it very seldom breaks out into full balls out action mode. It's more of a conspiracy thriller for a lot of it. I actually quite enjoyed the early stages of the film when the Natasha Kinski character appears to be dead and the Charlie Sheen character is kind of trying to navigate that, because he's highly suspicious of what occurred, and he's finding all these clues pointing to some sort of shenanigans. He breaks into her apartment and discovers a fucking photo of her in skydiving garb, with a parachute on her back, serving as evidence to the fact that she was more experienced than she let on, and just the fact that she was so anxious to get up there so quickly. It was all very suspect, and the extent of his investigation is maybe a little far-fetched, but it makes some sense. And the one downside, I guess, is that aside from the two major villains, Gandolfini and Christopher McDonald, there aren't that many expendable goons, which is fine in this case because Natasha Kinski's character is supposed to be very much like not wanting to have a stand-up fight with any of these people. She's very much trying to use subterfuge and guile to handle them, and her sidekick is Charlie Sheen, Ditch Brody, who is a skydiver slash gymnast, not a fighter or a soldier. So it wouldn't make sense to stack the odds too heavily against them in terms of like numbers and overall competency of the opposition. But in general, the villains come across as a little bit incompetent and just not very threatening, because Christopher McDonald is a cartoon character. Like he's he's Paul Giamatti in The Amazing Spider-Man 2. He's just he's sometimes doing a little bit of a Russian something or other with his voice. Occasionally he does speak Russian, but for the most part, he's just screaming, sweaty, and not amazing at fighting. Because Charlie Sheen does actually, like, he doesn't beat him, but he does, like, plow him over and escape from him. So in general, like, the villains aren't especially thrilling, or threatening, rather. Which is kind of a letdown. And also, like I said, it very seldom breaks out into, like, balls out action mode. It's more just like escape sequences and occasional flare-ups of brief violence. Like there's a brief shootout when James Gandolfini is finally revealed as the actual villain of the movie, because up to that point, about the halfway point of the movie, he's been playing Charlie Sheen and pretending to be, I think, a assistant DA or something that is levying a case against him, but willing to work with him in like building a case for like a pro case for him in terms of like wrongful death of the Natasha Kinski character. But then he has his heel turn, and it's pretty cool. It brief gunfight immediately after that sequence, nothing special, but that is the bit where we get Charlie Sheen's gun locking up and him declaring it broken. And immediately after that, we get a moment that very, very much felt like Die Hard 2. There's a sequence in Die Hard 2, if you're not familiar, you more than likely are, but just to refresh your memory, there's a sequence in Die Hard 2 wherein John McClane is in a plane and all the villain characters have him pinned down in there, and they decide to throw grenades into it. And they have him pinned down by shooting a lot of bullets over his head and stuff. And long story short, the way he gets out of that jiffy, that shitty situation, is he hits the ejector seat of the plane. Plane explodes, and then we get this lovely green screen shot of a blue screen shot, probably, of Bruce Willis flying upward into the camera. It's kind of a strange looking shot, if I'm being honest, but it was all over the commercials and trailers for that movie. We get almost a straight up replication of that, including ejector seats and people on a blue screen with an explosion behind them. And Die Hard 2 most certainly came out before this film. Also, very much worth pointing out, perhaps most important to all of the films I'll be talking about this month, Cliffhanger came out in 1993. The Rennie Harlan directed Cliffhanger. And the reason I emphasize that so much is that in a lot of ways that feels like the prototypical example of this not quite subgenre slash subcategory of action thriller that I'm kind of inventing for this podcast. A lot of the tropes and trappings of that movie are expressed in a lot of the other movies that I have in mind for this month. But in particular, the opening of that movie felt quite a lot like the plot catalyst for this movie, where it involves, I mean, not to spoil Cliffhanger, which, better movie, hate to say it, a movie that I would love to talk about with Kyle, to be sure. That's why I'm not talking about it on my own, is because I need a buddy to talk about Cliffhanger with, because that one, there's a lot to be said about. The opening of that movie involves an incident similar to the incident in this film. Although the drama in Cliffhanger is unbearable. Like, I know people who were traumatized by the opening cliffhanger. I don't blame them. I personally was not, but I know a lot of people that scene really, really fucked with them. Probably because I saw it too young. Most definitely because I saw it too young. Also, it's just a harrowing sequence. Very, very well acted on the part of the gal in that sequence. Like, Stallone did fine, but the gal sold the fuck out of it. But yeah, there's a rocket sled moment kind of similar to Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, followed by that beat that, as I said, involves an ejector seat and a fiery explosion. I really hated the slow motion effect applied during the rocket sled sequence. It's kind of that jittery, not quite actual slow motion effect. Felt like something applied in post-production, like during the editing process, rather than intentionally shot on the day of. It just comes across as chintzy, is all. It didn't hurt the film or anything, but, you know, it's worth pointing out. Stuff like that you notice and it bugs you. Also worth mentioning, I guess, is that apparently Tom Cruise, at one point, was slated to star in this film. Directing as well. He was slated to star. I don't think he would have benefited from this movie on his resume in 1994. He was doing better things. But perhaps most importantly, and if Kyle's listening, I seriously doubt he is, Kevin Reynolds was penned as director at one point. Now, Kevin Reynolds is, of course, a prolific collaborator with Kevin Costner. Who directed one of Kyle's favorite nostalgia films, Robin Hood: Prince of Thieves, as well as not Kyle's favorite nostalgia film, Waterworld. Kevin Reynolds also wrote Red Dawn. So he has a pretty diverse background with action cinema. He probably would have done just fine with this film. As I said, the movie never really officially breaks out into full-blown action mode until its final reel, where it tries to become like a roller coaster stunt spectacular. Doesn't quite nail it because of the nature of the stunt work, where it's aerial stunts, but it's also just like, you know, rescues and escapes. I personally, part of the reason why like this movie and quite a lot of the other movies I'm going to be talking about this month are ones that I've never seen before, is because when it comes to my action diet, I'm more attracted to martial arts specifically, but just, I hate to say it, like, I don't know what it says about me, but violence is very much a selling point for me in my action cinema. It's got to have a body count. It's got to have people getting punched. Those are my favorite things in film. And this movie doesn't have a whole lot of that. It's more about danger, adventure, and stunts, which is great. You know, that's great, except I prefer a balance. Like, I like a good... That's why Indiana Jones works so well for me. It's because you get it all. You get harrowing danger, but you also get punching and shooting and stabbing and stuff and whips and stuff. You know, you get it all. Whereas this one, it's more about guys doing stuff crazy high in the air and trying not to get killed, as opposed to like shoot the bad guy kind of action. So it's a personal preference kind of thing, but in general, I'm more impressed by stunt work and action films more based in action and like violence, as opposed to pure spectacle and danger. I will point out that the movie almost like signals that it's going into like action mode in its finale, because Joel McNeely did the score for the film, and it very much kind of kicks into high gear for the whole last segment of the movie. Very much kind of reminded me a little bit of tonally, it sounds like an Alan Silvestri score a little bit, but some aspect of it made me think of Michael Kamen as well, who was a very prolific composer of action cinema in the late 80s and early 90s in particular. And also just something about the structure of the tracks that play over the finale of the movie kind of made, like, really made me feel the spirit of John Williams's work for a Raiders of the Lost Ark. Like, it is not similar, like, on a compositional level. Like, they aren't musically similar. It's just the spirit of it made me think of that the truck chase piece of music from Raiders of the Lost Ark, if that makes sense. And quite a lot of it feels similar. Like, the things that are happening in the movie kind of feel like that, where it's like Charlie Sheen is planning a daring rescue. Like, he has to catch up to a plane so he can get a thing and save the gal and stuff. It kind of has that nature of, like, Indy's got to catch the truck to get the Ark and stuff. Although in this case, it's Charlie's got to catch the plane to get the girl in the trunk of a car at 10,000 feet in the air. Go figure. But yeah, Joel McNeely's score is just fine. It's nothing amazing, but I will give him quite a lot of credit for the action finale. It's quite nice. And the action finale is pretty good as well. The build-up to it's pretty cool. I actually really liked the scene between Charlie Sheen and Natasha Kinski. It's straight out of a rom-com, honestly. It's like the live revealed sequence. Basically, it's the boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl back. It's the boy loses girl scene. They're in a bar together, and they get into an argument, and he is such a shit. Like, he is such a little stinker. Like sometimes the girlfriend will tell me that I'm such a little... She says, "You're such a shit." And it's like, yeah, I know. I can be a dick. I'm sorry. It's hereditary. I get it from my dad, and my brother has it too. It's genetic. Sorry. He is such a dick in that sequence, so, and it kind of worked for me because he's petulant. But you kind of don't blame him because, like, this is a person who's never been shot at before, and it's happened quite a lot within the past couple of days of meeting this gal. So he's, like, justifiably irritated. Like, come on, lady. But she has this whole thing where they have this, like, intimate moment, like, the night before that, where they're sharing a bottle of tequila, I think, and she drinks the worm. I kind of like that, where it's like a subtle demonstration of her, I don't know, the incredible nature of her character, that she's like a Russian super spy type character. At least that's how she's presented. She's like a really good spy, and he's just a skydiver / gymnast, which is Olympic level gymnast. You know, like, he's kind of cool in his own right, but he's not presented as such in the film. He's kind of a clown in this movie. But she, like, opens up to him a little bit and, like, tells him about her family and her three-legged dog, put a pin in that. And she, like, actually gets upset with him about the fact that it's like, I opened up to you, man. Like, I was really kind. Like, I told you things that, as a spy, I generally don't tell people. And he's like, whatever. It's kind of cool. Also, there's a bit where she slaps him on the butt. And she tells him, like, get on the plane. She's like, up you go. That was kind of cute. Like, it's kind of a callback to, it's like a flip of the, like, the sexism, I guess, where it's like he was objectifying her upon first meeting her, and now that she's revealed to be a spy and, like, has pulled one over on him very, very, very successfully in the form of faking her death and whatnot, now, like, she's holding all the cards, and she's like, well, you know, right back at you, buddy, and she slaps him in the ass. It's kind of cool. But anyway, she does get captured by the bad guys. He speeds off to a hangar, and I really love the bit where he convinces a fella to fly him parallel to the plane, or, like, yeah, parallel to the plane so he can catch it in midair. He pretends to be an FAA agent and deputizes this guy that, I forget the name of the actor, but he's the, I think, the owner of the, was it the... he's like one of the producers of Ed Wood's films, in the Tim Burton film. He's the one that wants a big explosion at the end. If you know that guy, I don't know his name, but he's always welcome. He's a bargain bin James Cromwell. We'll call him that. Anyway, he convinces bargain bin James Cromwell to fly him up, to take care of the plane. By the way, as I'm having this conversation with myself, I think it's worth looking up. When did The Rocketeer come out? Funny that, 1991. So The Rocketeer came out a good solid 3 years prior to this. They're not especially similar, but they are somewhat similar. both feature quite a lot of aerial stunt work. Both feature, you know, men in goofy headgear doing aerial stunt work and, you know, flying in biplanes and stuff. So yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if maybe some of the same stunt team worked on this or something. Just to satisfy my own curiosity, I was curious when The Rocketeer came out. But anyway, yeah, the action finale in the movie is unfortunately cut a little bit short. Like, it doesn't amount to much. Christopher McDonald's car has been loaded into the ramp of the large cargo plane, and Natasha Kinski is actually locked in the trunk of it. Charlie Sheen manages to get into the back of the plane by hopping off of a biplane, which is a pretty cool fucking stunt. Also, the rolling flip that the biplane does, also pretty fucking cool. Pretty sure I've seen some stuff like that in The Rocketeer as well as maybe a few James Bond movies, but hey, it's cool here. It was cool there as well. And Christopher McDonald tries to shoot at him, which accidentally causes damage to the cargo plane, which forces it to be grounded, which is a very lazy way of forcing the finale of the movie, because our heroes don't, the cops catch the bad guys in this movie. Our heroes have almost nothing to do with it. Like, they unintentionally ground the plane by having Christopher McDonald shoot a pipe in the cargo hold, which feels very artificial. And it just felt like that maybe they didn't know how else to, a solution for the logistics of ending the movie and having the good guys win. Very, very lazy in that way. But yeah, Christopher McDonald and Charlie Sheen and Natasha Kinski all fly out the back of the cargo hold of the plane. And there's a very cool stunt here where there is a man hanging off the hood of the Cadillac Alante. And there's also a man in the driver's seat of it. And we don't see the person in the trunk, but it's a really cool stunt involving multiple people hanging off of a falling car in mid free fall. Apparently, it was achieved via trick photography. Like, they didn't actually drop 50 cars so they could repeatedly shoot the sequence with an actual falling vehicle. Apparently, it was achieved using a camera rig attached to a helicopter, which is actually carrying the car in mid-flight. It looks great. It looks utterly convincing. Just say that much. Christopher McDonald, we don't actually get to see him hit the ground, but he does not have a parachute, and he is separated by quite a distance from Charlie Sheen, who does have a parachute. So we can very safely assume he plummeted to his death, which, you know, it would have been cool to actually see the fall. But, you know, actually, no, what you would do there is you would have a wide shot and then composite in just a tiny doll in the background of a shot, just like a little speck in the background of a shot, just and then for censorship reasons, we don't need the grim details of it. You just see a little speck of something in the background of a wider shot. Oh, that's what happened to him. In the words of Ernest P. Worrell. There's a harrowing stunt where Charlie Sheen has to open the trunk of, he has to get the keys out of the ignition of the car and insert them into the trunk in mid free fall, and then pull Natasha Kinski out, and then they have a callback to the tandem jump that she had refused upon their first meeting, and he's like, "We finally got that tandem jump," which is kind of a lame 80-yard line, if I'm being honest. I mean, it's on the nose. You know it's going to be said before it happens, but it's you know, you can do better than that, buddy. Funny enough, I think I said put a pin in that, or I said I would get to that later. I apologize for that. My personal history with this movie, I never actually expressed that. I don't have any. But that's not entirely true. So I have never seen this movie front to back. Very familiar with the VHS cover. Saw it at the grocery store and at the Blockbuster all the damn time. But I'd never seen this movie front to back. I only knew what it was. I knew what it was about. I knew it involved aerial stunts. I mean, the cover all but spells that out to you. Major caveat. I have seen the end of this movie, literally the last couple of minutes of this movie, several times. It was on Encore or HBO, probably Encore, honestly. It was on that and a lot of cable networks like TNT and TBS and USA in the United States. It was on a lot of cable networks very frequently, and I believe the Encore network very frequently at one point in my life. But for whatever reason, I only ever saw like the last couple of minutes of the movie, but I saw it a lot. So I'm like intimately familiar. It's kind of unfortunate that like I had the James Gandolfini reveal completely spoiled for me when I was very young. I didn't know that there was a reveal. I just thought, oh, he's the bad guy in the movie, because spoiler alert, he's the bad guy at the end of the movie. After Charlie Sheen and Natasha Kinski parachute to safety, they land in a wind farm, which their landing routine kind of made me think of Mission Impossible 3, the J.J. Abrams directed Mission Impossible. There's a sequence where they're trying to rescue Felicity, where they have to maneuver a helicopter through a wind reactor farm. It's a J.J. Abrams film, so of course it's everything is dialed up to fucking 11. His movies have no goddamn chill. Like every crisis in a J.J. Abrams movie is dialed up to fucking 11. It's like they have no chill. It gets on my nerves sometimes. It's very effective. It has a wonderful bouncy energy to it, but sometimes it's like, buddy, we gotta slow down. That sequence, the number of things being juggled, like trying to save Felicity, trying to maneuver the helicopter, trying to fight the helicopter, all that stuff is harrowing and engaging, but good God, it is noisy, and the light flares, the light blooms, the anamorphics, it's so it makes me feel like I'm gonna have a seizure sometimes. anyway, conversation for a different day, maybe, probably not. They land in a wind reactor farm, and they hang out for a bit. Seems like they're safe. It feels like the pre-ending of a slasher movie or something. But then James Gandolfini swoops in on a parachute and he fucking drop kicks both of them. It's like, damn, Gandolfini off the top rope with the missile drop kick. As God is my witness, he's broken in half. It's pretty great. And then you get to see him flex his villainous chops a little bit by holding up Natasha Kinski as hostage and then telling Charlie Sheen, hey, look at this, buddy. Look at this ditch. This is for you. And then he stabs her. She gets better, though. She doesn't die. And then Charlie Sheen channels his nerd rage, and it's not quite a spear, or for that matter, if we're talking Rhino from ECW, a gore, but he does tackle James Gandolfini, and he does land some good punches. I will say, Charlie Sheen's got a convincing left hook to the body. Like it had some snap on it. I was like, damn, show me more of that, Carlos Estevez, show me more of that. But no, he lands a couple of punches on James Gandolfini, but, you know, given Gandolfini's size and the fact that he's like a KGB agent in this movie, Charlie Sheen can't win this fight. Like, I don't care how much nerd rage he has over his lady being stabbed. It just doesn't make sense on paper to have Ditch beat Pinkwater in a fist fight. It's just not correct. And thankfully, they don't do that. They have him kind of do a... actually, the backdrop feels very, very similar. He kind of pulls a License to Kill on him, or a Indiana Jones on him. What I'm referring to here is how I kind of started this conversation with... you remember how I mentioned that the 90s was the era of like the squirrely and resourceful hero as opposed to the Herculean invincible hero, like not a Schwarzeneggerian or a Seagalian hero, but more of a Reevesian, a Keanu Reevesian hero, where it's like, you know, he looks like he can handle himself, he looks like he's athletic, but he's not any, like, it's believable that he's kind of an ordinary guy, albeit remarkably handsome and eternally youthful in the case of Keanu. So I take that back. But anyway, a lot of more resourceful and borderline lucky heroes were common in the 90s. And If you're not aware, the James Bond movie, the Timothy Dalton one, License to Kill, ends with him and Robert Davi. Kind of, I forget if they have a fight or if it's just like a brief showdown or something, but it ends with James Bond setting him on fire via a very important prop in the film, a lighter that he has. And it's because Robert Davi, you know, is not really paying attention to his surroundings. You never learn to mind your surroundings, to quote Batman Begins. That's another example, I guess, No, that's an example of the student surpassing the mentor, or remembering the lessons imparted to him by the mentor. James Bond sets the bad guy in License to Kill on fire because he doesn't really pay any mind to the fact that he has a lot of gasoline on him, and fire bad. And also Indiana Jones in Raiders of the Lost Ark, the big goon, the big Nazi that fights him at the plane. Indiana Jones loses that fist fight, but he wins the whole damn thing by just waiting out his opponent and tricking him into standing in front of a whirling propeller blade, which is kind of exactly what happens here, where it's like, our clever and resourceful hero wins not through brute force, but through, you know, a little bit of luck and cleverness. So Charlie Sheen gets wrapped up in a bear hug, a proper bear hug, chest to chest, and with his feet suspended above the ground. This will kill you. You will asphyxiate and break some ribs. And just so happens that Gandolfini is still wearing his emergency suit. Like, he never took his gear off after that sensational dropkick to announce his arrival. And Charlie Sheen pulls the cord. And because they're in a wind reactor farm, he gets pulled by a breeze, which yanks him off his feet. And then, unfortunately, we don't get to see it, nor do we get a amazing sound effect. But long story short, James Gandolfini gets pulled back on his parachute and gets thrown into one of the aforementioned wind reactors and presumably sliced to bits. It is kind of cute that they speed up the footage of the whirling blades, because those blades rotate, but they don't rotate like super fast, but like for the shot to like signal to the viewer that this is going to kill this guy, they like have a head-on shot of the propeller spinning. It's like, yeah, those don't really do that. Like, that looks like a fan that I have at my house. But yeah, we do get like a blood smear on one of the propeller blades. So it's like, yeah, if you've seen Raiders of the Lost Ark, you have an idea what happened to that guy. It's a big guy. It's a big mess, presumably. The very charming end of the movie sees Charlie Sheen and Natasha Kinski going to Moscow, like actually going to Russia. And from what I can tell, they actually did film in Russia. Because there's a shot playing over the end credits of the film of the two actors, either that or like really, really, really convincing body doubles. Whoever that man was with that coif, with that Elvis-like hairdo, really looked like Charlie Sheen. I'll just say that much, at least from behind. And we have a Star Wars-esque medal ceremony, which is a callback to Charlie Sheen being a character who did not get to participate in the Olympics, where he was presumably going for the gold. And he is awarded some sort of Russian accommodation in the form of a gold medal, which is very, very cute. But the real kicker is the last line. His last lines in the movie are just utterly charming. he is awarded the medal kind of unexpectedly. He's just there to support Natasha Kinski's character, honestly. And by the way, there is a kid with like a curly red mullet sitting behind him that is one of the most amazing heads of hair I've ever seen, this side of Randall Tex Cobb in Ernest Goes to Jail. Look it up. Both the end of this movie and, you know, Randall Tex Cobb in general, worth looking up. Anyway, Charlie Sheen gets his medal, again, very Star Wars like, and his line is, his flat delivery of it and the subtitles are just, I love it. Maybe it's not as funny to you, but He said he speaks in Russian, but of course he's a goofball. Like he's Charlie Sheen. So the translation reads on the screen in the form of subtitles that read, "Buses don't work here. I am an asshole." It's like things I wish I could have tried to say to my girlfriend's mother in Dutch upon first meeting her. Like that's the first impression I want to make anywhere I go. Just learn how to say those two sentences in that language. It's like, meet the Prime Minister of Japan. Buses don't work here. I'm an asshole. It's great. But then the real kicker is, I mean, we get some sight gags in the form of him saluting the military personnel in the room or in the outdoor venue and like testing them, where he does a shikaka. If you've ever seen Ace Ventura 2, When Nature Calls, Chicago! He does that, but with his hand, where he fakes a salute and they bite for it. It's cute. But then as the ceremony is wrapping up, he gets to meet Natasha Kinski's family. And hey, wouldn't you know it, despite him like criticizing her of probably lying to him about her family and about Russian affairs in order to get him on her side, like to basically to convince him to help her in her task, he is shocked to discover, oh hey, that three-legged dog that she said she had, there he is, Tripod. He's at the ceremony, and we get a freeze frame on Tripod, which is very strange, but hey, you know, it's a callback joke, and it's, you know, it's kind of worth seeing in there. And yeah, the last image of the film is the two of them walking along a riverbank in the city, taking Tripod for a walk, which is very cute. And in general, it's kind of a cute movie. Like it's, I don't see this as being anyone's favorite action thriller. It doesn't have enough of anything really to be a classic, but it's inoffensive. And I find Charlie Sheen to be very affable, kind of effortlessly funny throughout. And the novelty factor of seeing James Gandolfini at this stage in his career doing the things that he's doing in this film is very, very high for me personally. So it has some stuff going for it, but as I said, it's nobody's favorite, not a classic by any means, but it's a very competent little caper film. Has some like De Palma or Hitchcockian vibes in terms of concept, but in terms of execution, it's not tense enough or slick enough to be anything particularly remarkable, but it's a fine Sunday afternoon watch. I'll just say that much. I've said way more than I expected to say about this movie. I feel like I'm going to have a mini stroke after this, being as I'm very dehydrated and have been talking to myself for way too long. So this was my solo review of Terminal Velocity from the year 1994. September of 94. Keep that in mind, because I have a few more 1994 films planned, none of which include Cliffhanger or Speed. So bummer, but those movies are too good for the amount of time that I have to devote to the podcast this month. So we'll get to them eventually. But yeah, this was directed by Darren Sarafian. And if you'd like to catch up on any of our other Catching Up on Cinema content, you can find all of that collected on our website at catchinguponcinema.com. You can also find us on the social medias in the form of the Twitter / I guess we're calling it X. I'm still calling it Twitter, at Catching Cinema, as well as the Instagram at Catching Up on Cinema. So feel free to hit me up at either of those. And the podcast is available on pretty much every platform you can imagine, including Bitcade. So fucking Google it. And that being said, thank you so much for listening. Hopefully it wasn't a chore, and we will catch you next time.